You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud.
When Paul Beatty won the Man Booker Prize last October for his brilliant new work, The Sellout, it was the first time an American writer had won the award. One of the judges commented about this wildly inventive novel. "The truth is rarely pretty, and this is a book that nails the reader to the cross with cheerful abandon." Or as poet Kevin Young wrote in his perceptive New York Times review, "The Sellout isn't for the faint-hearted." And that's all of you here tonight. Paul Beatty grew up in Southern California and began writing hip-hop poetry when he was in his mid-20s. In 1990, he became the Grand Slam champion of the New Yorkin Poets Cafe. In addition to The Sellout, which, by the way, is also the winner of the 2015 National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction, Paul Beatty is the author of three other novels, two books of poetry, and the editor of Hokum, an anthology of African-American comic writing. Paul is here with us tonight from his home in New York City, where he teaches creative writing at Columbia University. The Sellout is laced with tragedy and humor. The protagonist, an urban farmer and pot smoker, grows up on the outskirts of LA in a town called Dickens, and is homeschooled by his father, a controversial sociologist, as a race experiment. After his father is killed by the police during a traffic stop, the protagonist embarks on a controversial social experiment of his own and ends up before the Supreme Court. Beatty's provocative prose tackles the complexity of racial and economic inequality in America as he pushes plot and reader alike into new and unfamiliar territory. In conversation with Paul is novelist Dana Johnson. Also a SoCal native, Johnson is the author of the recent story collection In the Not Quite Dark, lauded by Publishers Weekly as essential reading for Angelenos, Californians, and anyone interested in masterly, morally engaged storytelling. She is also the author of the novel Elsewhere, California, and Break Any Woman Down, winner of the Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction. Dana Johnson is professor of English at the University of Southern California. As first-time guests on the Aloud stage and together for the first time in Los Angeles, let's give a warm welcome to authors Paul Beatty and Dana Johnson at the LA Public Library.
Everybody, and I think I'm not alone in feeling very lucky to be able to be with Paul Beatty here tonight. And so I thought we would just start the conversation with Paul reading the beginning of his prologue of The Sellout so that you get a sense of what we're getting ourselves into tonight. And if you would, please.
This may be hard to believe, coming from a black man, but I've never stolen anything. Never cheated on my taxes or at cards. Never snuck into the movies or failed to give back the extra change to a drugstore cashier, indifferent to the ways of mercantilism and minimum wage expectations. I've never burgled a house, held up a liquor store. Never boarded a crowded bus or subway car. Sat in a seat reserved for the elderly, pulled out my gigantic penis, and masturbated to satisfaction with a perverted yet somehow crestfallen look on my face. But here I am in the cavernous chambers of the Supreme Court of the United States of America, my car illegally and somewhat ironically parked on Constitution Avenue. My hands cuffed and crossed behind my back, my right to remain silent long since waved and said goodbye to, as I sit in a thickly padded chair that much like this country isn't quite as comfortable as it looks. Summoned here by an officious-looking envelope stamped important in large sweepstakes red letters, I haven't stopped squirming since I arrived in this city. Dear sir, the letter read, congratulations, you may already be a winner. Your case has been selected from hundreds of other appellate cases to be heard by the Supreme Court of the United States of America. What a glorious honor. It's highly recommended that you arrive at least 2 hours early for your hearing scheduled for 10 a.m. on the morning of March 19th, the year of our Lord. The letter closed with directions to the Supreme Court building from the airport, the train station, I-95, and a set of clip-out coupons to various attractions, restaurants, bed and breakfasts, and the like. There was no signature. It simply ended, sincerely yours, the people of the United States of America.
Yeah, thank you. So that's the beginning of the sellout, and we soon find out that the narrator, me, named me, is at the Supreme Court because he's in trouble for acquiring a slave named Hominy, also resegregating his hometown of Dickens. And it's such an amazing premise, a mind-bending premise, and it made me think of America and the sort of twists and contortions we've gone through in order to categorize people, et cetera. And so I just wanted to ask you, Paul, and this is one of these questions that writers hate, but how did you come up with this conceit? What got you thinking about a black man owning a slave and resegregating his hometown?
Oh, I don't know. I think there's like a line in the book where the son asks his father where the ideas come from, and he goes, I don't know. The important part is what happens when people steal them. I mean, it's just, yeah, I don't know where it came from. I mean, it comes from a lot of stuff. I mean, I think, like, I don't know if it's the initial thing, but I just the idea of, I know I'm a big Little Rascals fan, I guess, and I just had this long little, you know, revisiting the phase, and me and my sister talk about the Little Rascals all the time, and I have a friend Jerry Chacon, me and him talk about the Little Rascals, and I had some friends from school, from college, anyways, but. I don't know, at some point, you know, I was just like paying attention, and there was a little guy, his name is Buckshot. No one knows who Buckshot is, but my guess is that he was like the next in line, you know, for the little, you know, the black males thing. So I just, the idea of Buckwheat's understudy came to me a long time ago. And so, I know you laughed, I took it very seriously, but, but I love that idea. And like, you know, where is that person now? You know, like that person, like where is that person? So, I mean, that was part of it. And the other stuff, I don't know, just comes from all kind of places. Yeah. You know, just years of people going, oh, I don't know who we is necessarily, but I guess they mostly mean, you know, we as black Americans are better off under segregation. You hear people say that every now and then. Mm-hmm. And just always, you know, make me raise an eyebrow. And I understood, you know, the sensibility, but I thought it'd be kind of weird to just look at all this stuff in a contemporary context, you know, like what all these things mean and feel like, and you know, the ideas just come from thinking, really, you know. I tend to hold on to stuff for a long time, and I don't write very often, so it's like, you know, 30 years of remarks that I just throw in there.
I grew up on the Little Rascals too, because it's been in syndication forever. Seems like we've all grown up, that and Lucy. And I was thinking of Hominy as a character because the way you write him is so funny, and he gets some of the more humorous lines, but underneath all that is this really interesting and sort of, I think, sad conversation about sort of black figures in film and television and how, what they had to go through then and sort of what I think Black folks in television and film can be seen as going through now. And that's devastating, the some of the passages we read about Hominy and what he goes through. And one of the characters says to Hominy, "You're a better man than I swear the Oscars need to give a Lifetime Achievement Award to the Black actor because you guys had it hard." And so I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about Hominy and why you connect him to the narrator as a slave, or just his character in general.
Yeah. So I had the idea for this character, I guess. And it comes from a lot of stuff. It comes from, there's like a Little Rascals feature movie. I don't know if anyone knows it, like from 31. Anybody know this movie? Like, takes place in the Civil War, like Little Spanky and Little Buckwheat kind of re-waged the Civil War. And it's not, you know, I don't know if they call it out, but whoever, I guess it is Buckwheat. He's kind of Spanky's slave in the thing. Mm. So, yeah, it's a strange, strange film. But, I think there's some of that there. You know, there's some, that trope. I needed a trope. Mm-hmm. You know, from the Brady Bunch, didn't Peter become somebody's slave? Somebody saved somebody's life on the Brady Bunch. And that always was weird to me, that episode, you know, that idea of I'm going to be your slave. And there was a guy who lived on our block named Eddie Smith, who in the 70s founded the Black Stuntman's Association. And me and, you know, the Chacones lived up the block. And every now and then we'd run over to his house. I mean, I watched all these Little Rascals. We didn't have a television for a long time. So I used to watch the Little Rascals at the Chacon's house. You know, we'd jam in there after school. And every now and then we'd go to see Eddie Smith, you know, because he was a stuntman. He was in the movies. And he would say, "Oh, I'm going to put you guys in the movies." Da, 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 da. It never happened, obviously. But anyways, but there's a lot of this Hollywood kind of stuff. And I think about these figures all the time, you know, Mantan Moreland, you know, all this stuff. And you know, one of the things with the Little Rascals is, you know, those guys were so charismatic and had just these difficult, difficult roles, you know. But you could just see their brilliance at some level. And a long time ago, I went to hear a guy named Amiri Baraka read. Mm. He was just reading and talking and, you know, and I don't know how it came up or why it came up, but he was talking about Step and Fetch It. Mm. And he was talking about, you know, how we just see things on the surface. And he started talking about Step and Fetch It, and, you know, he'd be in the movies, you know, he's got his white employer who's like, you know, Step and Fetch It, go, you know, pick up that bucket. You know, bucket's 40 feet away. And, you know, of course, it would take Step and Fetch It 40 minutes to go get the bucket, right? Mm. And Baraka was saying, you know, only the most servile person runs to get the fucking bucket, right? He goes, there's something in that, you know, there's a reason he's moving slow and all the kind of stuff. You know, whether that's the correct interpretation or not, that's an interpretation. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, shit. Yeah, that just, it was nice to hear him say that in a weird way. Mm-hmm. And, It just made me think about the layering of all this stuff, you know, and
Yeah, well, I just was, you said the word, I was thinking that it adds a lot of layers to this, what could be seen or what someone could argue very simplistically that, well, this is a racist film and how could they have done that and that must have been very difficult, etc. There's that, but then there's also this other artistry and perseverance, all of this other
thing. Yeah, I mean, it's, I don't, like, always operate out, it is or it isn't, you know?
Right.
I remember I listened to these people have a debate over this old Louis Armstrong photo. It's kind of famous. He's, like, in a leopard skin, mm-hmm. kind of loincloth, naked, you know, blowing the trumpet. And, oh, it's empowering, it's this, it's that, you know. So it's interesting about who says what it is. For me, that's the stuff that's interesting for me, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And the thing that, you know, I still think about, you brought it up earlier about, you know, like just the continued manifestations, you know, especially around humor and gesture and all this kind of stuff and what's different, what's not, you know, in terms of representation. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's just, for me, it's just a way to render some stuff that I'm thinking about.
I was actually thinking of Tyler Perry movies and the Tyler Perry franchise and how some people find them just sort of a reinscription of racist tropes, and other people think, well, you know, he's representing sort of black mothers in this way that is sort of paying homage or honor to them. And so it's one of those, it makes me think of The Little Rascals and how complicated that question is too, that there are these layers to that. Yeah. So the thing about Dickens in your novel, which is where your narrator grows up, one of the things that gets to him is that the neighborhood is all of a sudden not on the map. Street signs are disappearing. It's this place that is just sort of no longer, and part of that is because of gentrification and things becoming, I think Paul wrote, things are becoming a view or a dale or a height tacked on at the end of the names. And this is this idea of gentrification is ever timely everywhere, but especially in LA, where a neighborhood like Echo Park or Highland Park, all these various downtown where I'm living now, gentrifying. And so I guess my question is, one of the things that me misses about Dickens is community, and I guess I'm wondering what else, in addition to that, do you see happening when neighborhoods get erased and neighborhoods gentrify and they become Dickensdale or Dickens Heights or whatever you want to call it? Because that seems to be one of the big conversations you're having.
Yeah, I think like it's a... I think it's part... I remember getting in an argument with somebody who lived in Hancock Park. I don't know why that starts. Anyways, but she was like, oh, there's so many black people in L.A. And I was like, yeah, actually, there's not a ton of black people in L.A. But, you know, it's... And I think the population is shrinking. I don't know. But it started from there, this idea of just this population shrinking. But, you know, you mentioned the signage and stuff. And I don't know, where I grew up for the most part. Just the neighborhood never had a name, you know, but it's been trying to find an identity. And I drive, and there's all these signs, Los Angeles Heights, Rainier Park. I don't know. This forced thing. And it's always cracked me up. But, but it's, you know, even to this day when people ask me, like, you know, well, what part of L.A.? I'm just like, I don't know. It used to be West L.A. I don't know what it is now. But
yeah, we were talking about that at dinner, and you said something like, I don't know. It used to be.
Yeah, but it's funny because, you know, the Times has this cool site. I don't know, where they have the crime matched to the neighborhoods. Anybody know this on the L.A. Times site? Every now I go in there and see what little crimes have been committed, and, you know, and... But people argue about, like, the naming of their neighborhood. And then so, like, where I grew up, you know, people are saying, it is West L.A., you know, but, you know, because it's West L.A., but it's not, you know, certain parts of West L.A. anyways, I guess, you know, demographically. Anyways, this is just shit that I think about. I know I'm not making any sense, but, I don't know. I'm not very good at, like, saying, oh, this means X, Y, and Z, you know. So,
it's an unfair question.
But I like the idea of a neighborhood disappearing and, you know, what all that meant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just the idea of how we think about neighborhoods, sister cities, all this kind of stuff, you know. And so for me, that was really fun to do, to try to recreate the neighborhood. And, you know, based on little snippets. I mean, it's, if you know LA, it's sort of there, it's sort of real, sort of not, you know. And I'm gonna be quiet. So.
Okay. Well, this leads me to my next question, because you're born and raised here, but you've lived in New York for years. You teach at Columbia. And so I'm wondering, when you come back home, what are some of the things about Los Angeles that make you feel like you're home, or does it even feel like home anymore? And where do you go in order to have that feeling?
Yeah.
What is it about Los Angeles that seems a part of your identity?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've lived in New York for a long time. And so, you know, when I first got there, You know, I realized how hard I was trying to hold on to my LA identity, so I kept my license for as long as I could. And, you know, I used to try to go to Rockaway Beach and pretend like that was the beach and just, yeah, a lot of stupid stuff. I don't want to get into it. But, I left LA when I was pretty young, actually, but it's a place where I just kind of work out all my stuff. You know, it's the one place where it's not like I know LA very well, really, but it's a place where I'm familiar. Like, I'm just, I know my feet are on the ground. I might not know where I am, but I know where I'm at. And, that didn't make any sense, but, so it's, you know, and it's, you know, and like coming back, you know, every now and then. So, you know, in my head, you know, and you know, for a long time we lived in Santa Monica, not for a long time, but for a while, and just seeing how these neighborhoods change, and the density, just how different it is, and yet how familiar it is, especially in terms of language, you know. So it's tons of little things, like landing in the airport, you know, in 1989, renting a car to go home, and you just fly down La Cienega, right?
Right.
You know, and that how the traffic just backed up further and further and further and further and further, you know. And then, you know, so every 4 months, I'm like, man, and, you know. And so just, I don't know, there's so many little things. And it's, it's just a place I know. I mean, my friends are here, you know, people I've known forever, you know, close to 50 years. And, but, you know, my family's still here and, you know, I can't even, you know, a lot of stuff is gone. Taco Bell's still there. You know, it's just, I don't know. It's a place I don't know very well, but it's just so familiar. So.
Yeah. I was just thinking about, I lived here my whole life and I went to grad school in Indiana. We were talking about that. And there's something about the place that is very much a part of my being, so that whenever I came home, I was suddenly appreciating mountains or something. That was the thing that really struck me about coming home. But I had another question, and that was, I was wondering if you wrote your first novel, White Boy Shuffle, in New York, or did you write that
here? I wrote that in New York, yeah.
Wow. And so is it easier to write about Los Angeles in a place that's not, like, in a place that's vastly different? Like,
I never had a room in Los Angeles, so just, I don't have any place to write. So, I mean, I think that's part of it. So, you know, in New York, I have some space. So here, I don't really, you know, my mom is everywhere, so I can't, you know, really write. So, So I don't have any, so I think that's part of it. But it's just, I mean, that's, you know, where I started writing, and it's where I live, and, and it's not necessarily where my head is or anything, or, you know, where my stories are, but in some ways it's probably given me some distance, you know.
Right.
And, you get to make it up.
There's a fascinating, well, many fascinating parts in The Sellout, but there's something I was hoping you could read a section from on page 86, and you know, because I'm born and raised in LA, I really appreciate books that document in some way what makes Los Angeles particular compared to other places. But you talk about racial vortexes in this section that I'm going to ask you to read, where, quote, visitors experience deep feelings of melancholy and ethnic worthlessness. Places like Chavez Ravine, where a generation-old Mexican neighborhood was torn down. And that is a particularly devastating example of how a neighborhood gets completely erased. People just obliterate it in order to put Dodger Stadium there. So, but at the same time, in this section that you're going to read, there's a kind of lovely nostalgia for this place as well. And so the section gets at all these complications. So I was hoping you would read that on 86.
Hominy slumped in his seat and clasped his hands behind his head and looked out of the window into his past. I flipped on the radio and let the Dodger game fill the silence. Hominy missed the good old days and Sunshine Sammy. I missed Vin Scully, the dulcet voice of objectivity calling the play-by-play.
For a baseball Puritan like myself, the good old days were the days before the designated hitter, interleague play, steroids, and assholes in the outfield, baseball caps perched precariously atop their heads, flying off with every missed cutoff man and pop fly lost in the national pastime sun. They were me and Daddy, our mouths full of Dodger dogs and soda, two black bleacher and Dharma bums, sharing the June night heat with the Moths, cursing a fifth-place team, and longing for the good old days of Garvey, Say, Koufax, Dusty, Drysdale, and Lasorda. For Hominy, any day when he could personify American primitivism was a good old day. It meant that he was still alive, and sometimes even the carnival coon in the dunk tank misses the attention. In this country, the latent high school homosexual that it is, the mulatto passing for white that it is, the Neanderthal incessantly plucking its unibrow that it is, needs people like him. It needs somebody to throw baseball at, to fag bash, to nigger stomp, to invade, to embargo. Anything that, like baseball, keeps a country that's constantly preening in the mirror from actually looking in the mirror and remembering where the bodies are buried. That night, the Dodgers lost their third straight. Hominy sat up in his seat and rubbed a porthole into the suddenly fogged up windshield.
Thank you. That's such an amazing question. So the line that gets to me among many lines is anything that, like baseball, keeps a country that's constantly preening in the mirror from actually looking in the mirror and remembering where the bodies are buried. This is, you know, probably a tired question at this point because we're all exhausted after only 4 weeks of Donald Trump's presidency. But I want to ask you how you feel that line speaks to where we find ourselves now.
Yeah, it's not now. I mean, it's been forever.
Yeah,
you know?
Forever.
I mean, it took me 5 years to write this book. It's been out for like 2 years, you know. Mm. So it's not like this prescient kind of thing. I mean, you know. It's just depends where you're looking, you know, and what you want to see. And yeah, I do the same. You know, I'm not immune to that. So, yeah, I mean, you know, there's like a big psychological subtext. So that's not really a subtext, but, you know, undertone to the book. And it's one of those things that, you know, psych taught me is that often what you think is happening isn't what's really happening, you know, and it's how do you, you know, and attach an epistemology to that, you know? And so it's just something that I think about all the time. And, you know, I don't know, when I read that, I think of, what do I think of? I think of John Fonte's book, you know, Ask the Dust, which talks about a neighborhood that's not there, you know, Bunker Hill. I think of this beautiful movie called The Exiles. You know, about the same, you know, how that used to be a Native American community in the 50s, you know. And I think about the Dodgers, too, of course. But, you know, it's not like, I've been to Dodger Stadium a jillion times in my life. But, you know, they're just these, you know, memories that I exaggerate and make up, you know. And, you know, just like what's here, you know, in Acid Dusk, you know, set in the 20s, I guess. You know, he talks about, like, why, I guess he's down here. I forgot where I was. I'm downtown. I'm in LA. Yeah, I forgot about this. But, you know, he talks about, like, you know, sand blowing in the streets, you know. And just every now and then, I guess as I got older and realized what LA was and it wasn't, you know, every now and then I go, oh, yeah, it's a fucking desert. You know, it's like, you know. And, but that, I mean, that's just a geographical layer, you know. And, you know, but beyond that, you know, people live in the space, you know, at some level. And yeah, watching the Dodgers, there's a cost, you know, because there's not a ton in there about Chavez Ravine and, you know, how they just, you know, eviscerated the neighborhood, you know. And, but it's about, you know, what progress is, what changes, you know, it's, you know, yeah.
Yeah. I think about that a lot, living downtown, 12 years at this point, and just how much it's changed and who's been displaced and who's been sort of forced out of affordable housing because now it's going to be a $4,000 apartment or what have you. And just, again, the continuation of erasure and histories, people being displaced. Okay, so I want to get to the Man Booker Prize. Congratulations, by the way. And so you're the first American to win it. And folks like me, and I'm sure nearly everyone in this room who've been fans of yours for years since White Boy Shuffle, were like, yes, finally. Paul Beatty's gotten some like proper props, not just like kind of props, but like proper props. And I read that it took something like 18 houses before it was taken. And maybe this is a question that, of course, you might not have the answer to, but I was thinking about the difference between how Americans read or what the publishers think Americans read, and why and how it took Britain to acknowledge a writer like yourself who's been doing major important work for years. And so I'm just wondering what you think about the current world of publishing and kind of what they're missing or what they're not seeing, what they need to be paying attention to.
Yeah.
And what's the difference between American publishers and, you know, other folks?
That's a hard question.
I know.
I mean,
I know it is.
Yeah. So I'm not sure. I know what you're asking, but I don't think I can answer it, to be honest. But so, you know, like after I finished the book, you know, it's not like I had sold the whole book. You know, I had sold the first 50 pages or something. Mm-hmm. So I kind of knew where the book was, but it wasn't, you know, what it is, you know. And so the thing is, I didn't have to worry about, like, it being rejected. Like, you know, no, we can't handle that. But, you know, I'm lucky I have a really good editor. And, you know, he got it right away. You know, the first thing he said to me was, when he said I was insane, but but he said, you know, the book is so full of contradictions, but it all makes sense. You know, and I was like, okay, that's good. You know, and you know, when I got to London for this thing, I don't pay much attention to this stuff, to be honest. I just, you know, I pay some, but not very much. I mean, it's weird because, you know, I've been traveling since the prize and, you know, doing all this international press that, you know, I've done some, but not a ton of. And so it's interesting about how different places are responding to the book.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I've noticed is that the most interesting questions have come from India and Ireland. And, you know, because there's a tone to the book, there's an energy of vulnerability that I think it feels very familiar to them. This is my guess, you know, in part like what people tell me, you know. I'm not sure how to talk about all this, to be honest. But that's been interesting. And then so, you know, the rejection. So even the people that published the book in the UK rejected the book, you know. Mm. And there's a guy, I'm not going to really out him, but he's a book editor there. And he was like, no, this is crazy that no one's published this book. And he made them take another look at the book, you know, and they tried to do it. And then so people are always asking me, like, so, well, why did they do it? Not? I don't really know. You know, they might not like the book. They might not know what to do with the book, you know. And I think, you know, when I was writing the book, you know, at some level I was trying to write a book that you couldn't ignore, mm-hmm. or it'd be hard for you to ignore, you know. And doesn't mean you can't ignore it, you know. And so, but it's interesting because I haven't, you know, I would love to, I don't necessarily want to see it, but like no one goes to them and say, well, why did you pass? Why did you pass? Why did you pass? Why did you pass? You know, there's kind of, you know, it's not like how we operate. Like there's a part in there, you know, the character's father's a psychologist and he talks about like how all these great studies that, you know, don't show significant results never get published. Right. You know, no one says, hey, I thought this, but it wasn't the case. You know, I was wrong. You know, it's a little bit of that. We just never see that, you know. So I don't know why, you know. I mean, I think there's some distance. You know, I think there's some, you know, I've been getting, oh, you know, so how does this book relate to Italy? How does this book relate to here? How does this? And I don't answer those questions for people. You know, I don't know Italy. I don't know Romania. I don't know any of these places. So, you know, try to force them to do their, to just to be accountable. But I think, you know, part of it is whatever. Hopefully it's just a fucking good book. I mean, hopefully that's it. And yeah, I mean, I could go on with like what I think, you know, because I think, you know, British sensibility is different a little bit, you know.
Well, I'm interested because what do you think the sensibility is that's different from the American sensibility?
Yeah, it's just like if you look at movies, you know, American movies never had a toilet in them until 1970. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's like,
right.
There's a thing about just how we communicate and how we, you know, what do we want to hear? And I'm not trying to paint it as like some more open society or anything, but it's, yeah, I can't really answer it,
okay.
You know, to be honest. I mean, because I'd be making it up, you know.
Yeah.
I'd be making an answer that I want to hear, you know, that reaffirms something that I want to believe. So, and I don't want to do that. But, I mean, so I can say this, though. So when the book came out, you know, I was very nervous about, like, what the first reviews were going to be, because, you know, it's easy to read the book in some kind of way. And then so, fine, I got this really nice Times review, like, you know, all these really early reviews. But, like, you know, I have a very good friend of mine who I think has really good taste, who runs this magazine. And, you know, and he's like, Paul, send me something, send me something, send me something. I was like, okay, I'm going to send you this. And he didn't publish it. Mm-hmm. You know, that scared the shit out of me. I was like, man. And, you know, and my editor now tells me about, like, you know, so as soon as the book came out, the Paris review was like all over me, like, you know, I never send them anything, you know, they never asked me to do anything, I never send them anything anyway, but, you know, they're just, oh yeah, we've big fans, this and that, the other, and this and that, and he goes, yeah, we gave them the right to publish, you know, the initial stuff, and they said no, and it was like this sense, which, you know, I don't know if this is American or not, but this sense of always needing permission to laugh, to do this, to do that, and just saying, you know what, I like this shit, I'm doing it, you know, and
yeah.
I'm not saying that that's not the case in other places either, but you know, and it's, I mean, I live here, so I'm familiar with that a little bit, and so, but you know, but thankfully, you know, there've been people who've really read the book, mm-hmm. and you know, I talked to a couple of judges, you know, and it was just for me, just, you know, because I worked so hard on the book. Just to hear people, like, not talk about topical, but just to talk about the writing and the language.
Mm-hmm.
And they just went, yeah, yours was the best fucking book,
yeah.
You know? And, you know, all the other kind of, you know, it's, you know, no one deserves anything. You just get it, you know?
Yeah.
And, I don't know the answer, really.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, yeah, this is tangentially related, not really, but I just read somewhere that, I think it was your, a college professor once told you that you never were going to be a writer. I just wonder what was that all about, if you remember. He said you were no good, or you weren't going to be a writer. I love stories like I love people like you having stories like that.
Yeah. This was, I mean, you know, I got my MFA in poetry, so it was my first year. I had never written anything. I must have been about 25, I guess. I'm really struggling to figure out, you know, just how to, or, you know, put my thoughts on the page. And so at the end of that year, the professor, you know, you had to sit down and meet. I got a C+ in poetry. This is grad school, yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
I didn't even know it was legal to get a C+ in grad school, but it is. So I got a C+, and the professor told me, and she said, I don't think this is for you, really. You know, and it just brought up all this other stuff, you know. And so I was like, oh, okay. And then, but thankfully I had another person. It was kind of, we had these tutorials where you met one-on-one with somebody. And a guy named Lou Asikoff, who's a poet who I'm still very close to. And I was like, oh yeah, Professor So-and-so told me I should quit. And he was just like, he told me, he's like, no, you're on to something, you know? And I've been really struggling, you know, in class. You know, writing's hard. You know, I wasn't struggling anymore. I was just struggling. And he said, you're on to something. And he said something to me that really stayed with me. He was like, people are going to learn how to read you. Mm-hmm. And, I was like, oh, okay. And then, but it just, you know, the timing was really good because at the end of that year, I had finally written a poem that I liked, mm-hmm. You know, I was like, oh, I kind of like this poem. And I remember reading it in class, and there was this one kid who was like, I fucking hate this poem. I don't understand it. I don't get it. Blah, blah, blah. And so at the end of that year, summer went by, and then we had the same classmates, but we had a different professor. I had Ginsberg. And Ginsberg was like, bring in your best poem. We're going to start from there. So I brought in that poem because I thought it was my best poem, read it, and I didn't have to say anything about the poem. The same kid that hated the poem was going, oh, this is, Paul's a genius. He's making a reference to this and that. This is an allusion to blah, 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 you know. I was just like, and then, so I asked him, like, after class, I said, dude, you hated this poem, like, before. I was like, what happened? And he said, nah, I was in New York for 3 months, you know?
Right.
And it just, yeah, you know, but I was, you know, really struggling with, you know, who's responsible to do what. You know, and it wasn't like whatever I do, they'll understand. It wasn't like that. But it just, for me, it was like this thing of, oh, man, there's so much stuff going on. You know, we're just not all in the same place all the time. And Yeah. It's always shifting. And so, but that was just really important to me, to see somebody do that kind of 180, mm-hmm. you know. And it just, I don't know, I don't want to say it relaxed me or anything, but it just... It just allowed me to continue taking my time, really, yeah. you know, and you know, which I've been doing. So, yeah.
So, we're going to open it up to questions in a minute, but I had one last question, and it was a question about how you're sort of always consistently categorized as a satirical writer. And in reading The Sellout, it feels to me that, yes, irony and exaggeration and humor, these are all elements of satire, but there's something about what you're writing about and how you're writing about it that just feels truthful and not necessarily satirical, that it just is very close to just the absurdity of every day, of all things. And so I wonder what you think about that sort of stamp of satirical being called that and what that means. Yeah.
It's not a word that I use very often, you know. And I mean, I don't think, you know, in terms of tone and all this, this book is no different than anything else I've written, I don't think. So, but it's interesting that this word has come up, mm-hmm. you know, so much with this book. And I think it's one, it's a word that you can use and not say anything. You know, it's satire, blah, 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 you know. And so... I just one of those words that I know what people mean by it, but I don't really know what it really means when people use it. So, and it for me, it's also very limiting, that yeah. word, you know. And just I saw this Mark Twain documentary, and they were talking about, you know, Mark Twain at his old age on the road having to be a satirist. And, you know, I'm like, yeah, I'm not trying to do that. You know, I read somebody, I don't know if it's true, was telling me about another writer who was like, who wants to be the satirist, you know, so he's wants to wear the white seersucker suit, you know, and right. I was like, yeah, that ain't me. So it's too easy to hide behind the word. Like, I don't know what that says about anything, you know? And I was watching CNN about, I don't know, a month ago, and they had, you know, wrangled some fake news person, you know, and he's sitting in the chair like this. And they were like, well, why do you do this fake news? And what's with it? And the guy just went, it's satire, you know? And I was like, you know, just people just throw that word out. It just doesn't, you know, you can insult somebody and they get offended and you just go, oh, I'm just being satirical. You know, I'm not, yeah. you know, so I just, it's just, it, the word's just too limiting. You know, it's just, it's, I'm just uncomfortable with it. So, yeah.
Well, thank you for this amazing book. However long it takes you to write them, just amazing, important work. So thank you.
Thanks, Dana. Okay.
So, is there a mic or? Oh, there it is.
What were the interesting questions you got in India and Ireland?
Oh, I don't remember really, but Yeah, I mean, I think
it's a good question because I don't remember the questions. But
yeah, they were, because, you know, they weren't like the surface. What's it like to be a black writer? Blah blah blah. You know, just these. Yeah, just the same questions they ask everybody. You know, and but I think there was also a sense of import to the questions. You know, like really trying to tease out stuff that I don't necessarily like talking about, you know, and yeah, and you know, and questions about like what are my philosophical inferences in the book, you know, references. I mean, really stuff that had to make me think, like stuff that, you know, I try not to talk about, and yeah, because I don't like really trying to explain what I do because I can't really explain it very well. So, but yeah, just. It's one of those things where, you know, I feel like a lot of times I get questions that make the interviewer want to feel good about themselves, you know, and they weren't these kind of questions, you know, they weren't trying to prove anything to me or anything, you know, it's like there was a genuine curiosity, you know, and, but also like a very invested thing. You know, so people always ask me about a stupid question. What's a stupid question? I was like, for me, there's no stupid questions, but it's my sense of whether you really give a fuck when you're answering the question or you're just asking the question to be answered. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it affects how I talk to the person, you know, because, I don't know, I'm kind of a punk. So it's yeah, I don't know, but there was something, there was a genuine, you know, I got this one thing, and it was 25 questions. And I was like, okay, I'm not answering any of these. I'm going to answer like three. But they were so heartfelt. And so, you know, some like this thing, like we're all in this together kind of thing. And, you know, and so I answered every single one of them, you know. And, yeah, I wish I could answer it a little more succinctly. I don't remember exactly what they were, but I don't even remember what I write. So but yeah, but there was something there, you know. Yeah, I mean, because you could feel like there was something in the book that really meant something to them, you know. And, yeah, and you know, I just came from India, and you know, it was a crazy trip, and yeah. Sorry.
So in your novel, White Boy Shuffle, that captured me because it has so many parallels to my life. I mean, I rode skateboards, wrote poetry, I even had a Japanese wife. What inspired you to come up with the Gunnar Kaufman character, and that was just brilliant.
I don't know. I mean, I just got some stuff to get off my chest, you know. And yeah, I think, you know, I'd made a decision to stop writing poetry. I hated poetry, so I kind of wanted to write a book about a guy who fucking hates poetry, really. So I think that's a part of it, you know. And, you know, I had this, you know, the book's not what it originally set out to be. But somebody had asked me to write an essay about Generation X, is that what it is? Mm. And so I wrote, you know, and I had never written any prose before, but and I didn't want to do it, but I ended up writing a long essay that's kind of just the start of me and my friend Alan Ronald buying malt liquor at this liquor store on La Cienega. And this weird confrontation that we had in the liquor store. And then, you know, but it's a big, you know, thing. And then so, but in writing that, it was like, oh, shit, I know how to write this story that's been circling in my head, you know, about. Yeah, I just figured it out. And, yeah, I just, you know, you were talking about this satire thing and all this kind of stuff. And you know, I don't write like for a message, you know, I don't have like a message or I'm not trying to change anybody's mind or, you know, or change your heart or the way you think or anything. You know, I saw this, you know, I've been talking about this and I'm not very good at talking about it, but a guy sent me this YouTube. He did one of these things, but we were in Oxford. Wow. And he sent me this YouTube video of Nabokov talking about Lolita on television. And one of the things is the guy asked him, talking about Lolita as a satire. And I went, oh, I never even thought about that book as a satire. You know, it's just a good fucking book. You know, I can see why maybe then you might think that. because it makes you so uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. You know, you gotta just put that satire label on it. Anyways, I know I'm not answering your question. Sorry. But I don't know. I just had a funny story. I had like these little things, you know, that I wanted to get in the book, you know. And my friend used to have his little club name was Nick Scobie. I love that name. And so there's just little things that, you know, that I just tried to stitch together. And, you know, but, you know, you're talking about like, you know, I think part of it is, you know, like when I first started writing, you know, I was like reading all this literature and I was like, yeah, it's all fine, you know, it's all whatever, but there's something missing. And I'm going to use a word I never use, but there's this weird kind of universality missing. And I don't know what that means. And I wish I hadn't said it, but...
I was going to ask.
Yeah. So, but, you know, like, I had written that book, and, like, you know, I got these letters in the mail. And so one of the first letters was this kid wrote me this long 2-page handwritten letter. He was like, oh, this book is exactly like my life, you know, saying it. But he was a Vietnamese American kid. And I was like, oh, yeah, here we go. You know, and it's this thing of, yeah, and you're talking about like, you know, this India-Irish thing. And it was nice because they're talking about the book, but not like it's an African-American text, blah, blah, blah. Like African-American comes up, but not in the same way,
right.
You know. Yeah, not as category somehow. I don't know exactly what the difference is, but... You know, and part of me is, you know, I mean, I think about this, you know, in retrospect, you know, because I've been talking so much. But it's all just for me, it's like about creating this space, you know, and you're talking about White Boy Shuffle. And so, like, in that book, I had these two characters, Betty and Veronica, who I guess some people have read the book,
yes.
You know. And, these two young black women that kind of terrorized the central character. And so I had this idea in my head of, like, you know, like the hairstyle thing. What's that? And so I gave them, like, a geodesic dome, but it's on both their heads. You know, they're wearing the same hairstyle. But you know, and I was, like, nervous about that portrayal a little bit because I think, again, it could be read a certain way. But it was, you know, people would come up to me, whether it's accurate or not, like, these individuals felt this way about, oh, I'm so glad you put them in the book. Because you just never see black women characterized this way. You never see such and such character. And so I don't know. It's not like, you know, it's not offensive necessarily or it's not this, but... So that was like a book, like I had all these things running in my head and, you know, just trying to figure some stuff out, which is what I always do, I guess.
I love that book.
Thanks.
How often do you think about your audience when you're writing, or do you just write for yourself, or do you write thinking about that certain constituency?
Yeah, I don't really, you know, I mean, I can't say I don't at all, like, you know, it's like, but I don't think about the reader really, you know, and one of the reasons I stopped writing poetry is I was writing a poem, and I wrote a line, and I went, oh, they're gonna love that line. And I was like, who the fuck is they? You know, it's like, but no, I really stopped. You know, I really stopped me, you know, because I just never think about, like, I had just never thought about anything I wrote like that. Yeah. And it just really caught me off guard. And it's funny, I was telling this story to a young poet in London, and he went, isn't that what you want? You know, like, I was like, yeah, I understand that, but that's not what I want necessarily, you know? And just, you know, that conscious thing. So I think, like, over time, like, I've learned, like, you know, I'm not the only weirdo out there. So, you know, and I trust myself enough as a writer that there's going to be some appreciation for it. So, yeah, it's these are things that, you know, the thing about talking about this is kind of, I was at a panel and somebody asked me, wasn't the audience question, but they asked me and the other writers on the panel, like, you know, who are you writing for? And the woman said, oh, I write for everybody. And I'm trying to bring the reader in, and we're all in here together and all this kind of stuff. And these are things that I try not to think about, but I had to think about because I had to say something. But she said this, and I went, oh, I kind of do the opposite. Like, I push everybody away, especially at the beginning, you know? But, you know, but I try to leave the door ajar, like, a little bit,
right.
You know? You guys laugh. I'm not even trying to be funny, but it's... Yeah, I just, you know, I'm not the only asshole out there. So, just, Yeah. So, I mean, it's not like I don't think about it, but I don't have like a reader in mind, you know. Again, that would be just so limiting, you know. I mean, I read tons of good books. They had no idea I'm born. They're not writing to me, you know. Exactly. And it's like one of these things. Yeah, you know, it's how we're taught to read different kind of literature, you know. No one gave me Moby Dick and went, you're not in this audience. You know, they just gave us a good book, you know. So exactly. it's this weird way of like, you know, when this question comes up and, you know, who, why. And it's not just always about race necessarily, but yeah. Oh, my nigga, what's up? I was going to talk about you earlier, but I...
Paul Beatty, baby.
This is
boy.
My friend Ronald Keaton. Ronald, how long have I known you, homie?
Forever.
Yeah, dude.
Since sixth grade.
Yeah. So this is why I can't say nothing. He knows too much. So it's like, I can't say nothing. So.
I was going to ask a generic question. So you recognize. What truly inspires you to write these wonderful novels that you've created?
So, but it's like, okay, you remember I was talking about buying liquor store?
Yeah.
Okay, you remember when we first, St. Ives, right?
I remember it.
So I'm going to tell the story now that he's here. So, but these are like the events, you know, it's all memory, really, you know, and that you make up, you know? And so me, Ronald, and his brother, Al, me and Al were both home on college vacation. I don't know what year this is. This is back in early 90s, I guess?
Yeah.
So St. Ives had just came out. This is a malt liquor. So Cube used to have these commercials and all. Anyways, so, you know, I didn't know. You know, I was in New York. Al was Tennessee, I guess, somewhere. And so we come back. Ronald's like, oh, dude, you got to try the eyes. So we go into the store next to the Yum Yum Donuts. And there goes the St. Ives. And the 40s were like 99 cents. Each of them are a different color. You know, I was like, what the fuck? So we buy the things, and so we turn around. We come out of the ice box. We turn around, and then so the set that was in our neighborhood was the PBGs. So these three PBGs. I'm 6'1". Ronald like 6'3". His brother 6'4". And so these dudes have been terrorizing us our entire life, right? You know, we've been running from these niggas. It's crazy, right? So we turn around, we got our eyes, and these dudes back up off of us and let us walk through. So we pay our shit, and we get out in the lot, and we said, yo, and they cussed us as we back. They was like, these lurch motherfuckers, because we were, you know, twice as tall as they were. And then, do you remember this dude?
Like it was, yeah.
Yeah. So that memory of that thing sparked this whole essay. It's one of the best things I've written, actually. And it was about, it's not about that, but it's about all this kind of stuff, you know? And so for me, I don't have like this high-low culture thing. I just like what I like,
yeah.
You know? But that's, you know, you ask me like what's inspired. And, you know, I write about my friends, you know, they've inspired me so many ways, you know? And yeah, and so like the story I've been telling people, have been asking me about Trump. I'm gonna tell a story about you right now. And so, you know, and I had this whole, yeah, you see, that's it, yeah. So, this is the homie though. So it's like, I had this whole weird half-baked theory about white self-hatred and this whole thing about Trump. But it comes from when David Duke was running for governor in Louisiana. And I was at Ronald's house and we were watching the news, The Returns. And they had, he got, you know, 40% of the white vote. Da-da-da-da. And at the bottom, David Duke had gotten like 3% or something, 6% of the black vote. And Ronald ran up to the TV and went, who are these stupid motherfuckers, you know? But it was like one of those things, you know, and it's like really stayed with me because, you know, it just, no, but these things. And it's not like black and white, but just about how people think, why they operate, hominy, all this kind of stuff. You know, that's happening all at once. You know, none of it makes sense. And so, yeah, I mean, these are the little things that inspire me. Yeah.
That's a great.
What's the name of the essay that was inspired by that event?
It's It's called What Set You From Fool? Because, you know, they would ask us that, and we'd be like, I'm from nowhere. You know, what does that mean? You know, and just, and it, but it, part of it is like how I had to learn all these rules, you know, like how the, because the neighborhood changed around us, you know, like when we got there was mostly white and Jewish, you know, in a large part. And it just changed. Ronald came in from Chicago. He had to learn the rules, you know. You had to learn, oh, I can't say that. I can't do this. I can't do this, you know. It's not about that necessarily, but it's just about, you know, what a set means. You know, I'm using this nomenclature, but using it for, you know, different things. And so, yeah, that's what, it's in a book called Next or something, you know. And you know what's weird about that essay, though? Is the Walker Museum in Minneapolis made an installation out of the essay, which is so crazy. Yeah, it was so crazy. Wow. It was so crazy. Yeah.
With pictures of the neighborhood changing?
What's, I'm sorry, what?
With pictures of the neighborhood changing?
I can't even remember what was in there, really. I don't know if there were photos in there, really. I think they kind of did this. There might have been some photos. I can't imagine what they would have used, though. But they just kind of used the essay and just kind of, you know, put stuff on the walls, and yeah. It wasn't a great time for me, so, but,
yeah. Okay, thank you.
Hi, I'm so nervous. I was actually homeschooled myself, so I was super curious how you decided to make the dad a homeschooler.
Yeah, I don't know. I think part of it comes from watching. I love watching the Spelling Bee. And then they have all those homeschool kids, you know, who are always a little something. I'm too, part of it comes from me. I love the Spelling Bee. I mean, I've learned a ton about the country from watching the Spelling Bee. But yeah, I don't know. And it just made writing the book simpler, you know, just a little less things to pay attention to. And I just, I had a line in there that I liked. I can't remember what it was. Something about the father being an autodidact, but he had a shitty teacher or something like that. You know? So I just, you know, the thing was I was trying to just keep the book, like, everything just in one place, you know? I didn't want, like, a whole lot of travel. And so that's, I mean, there's a ton of reasons behind it, really, you know? And it's partly, like, the kids' isolation also, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah, as what is there a word to describe the difference between your LA people and your New York people?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, no, I don't think there's a word. I mean, they're all my friends, so yeah, they're not really. I mean, they're different, you know, but because I'm different, really. You know, I'm different here than I am in New York a little bit. So, yeah, there's people I like. Yeah, there's I I don't know. Is there a word, Evelyn? Is there a different word? I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it's, I met these people different, like, you know, different than people that you meet in the neighborhood, people you meet in college, people you meet in certain literary settings. I mean, so, you know, everyone's different, but, yeah, I mean, I think there are some differences between East Coast and West Coast people, you know, but if there's a word, I don't know what it is. I'm sure there is one.
Do you think West Coast people are more? What's it, laid back or chill?
No, I mean, it's changed a little bit, you know. But I'm going to tell all these stories that I'm never really telling in public. But yeah, I don't necessarily want to talk about
okay,
this.
Okay, okay. Fair enough. Fair enough.
The joy that you had in telling the story about Ron is the same feeling that I have when I'm reading the work. It's just so compelling. And I wonder, having heard you speak before, if that happens to you as you're writing, you go, oh, this shit is great, as it's just coming through you onto the page.
Yeah. I mean, I write till it means what I want it to mean, it says what I want to say, sounds the way I want it to sound. So, I mean, it takes a long time, but, you know, every now and then, I don't do it as much. I used to be a huge film person. You know, you'd go see these movies and, you know, your hair sticking up, you know, and these images, all this stuff is in your head. And so, you go see some installation at MoMA or something, you know, something's just happening. And I try to duplicate that for myself, you know, sort of a weird selfish thing to talk about. But yeah, you know, I want that way, you know, that excitement, you know, because I'm trying to, it's hard to do, you know, but yeah, because that's what happens when I read a good book or see something, you know, so I'm trying to do that for myself a little bit, you know, and when I do that, then I feel like I'm onto something, you know, if I can raise that same kind of way, you know, and yeah, so it's a matter of finding the right words, you know, and it's hard, but yeah, that's exactly it, you know, yeah, because it's, you know, like, audience and all this kind of stuff. I mean, these dudes are, you know, and my family, they're always there, you know, so, yeah, whether they read it or not, I don't know, but they always do.
Next question. I had a question if, I'm over here.
Oh, that's my niece.
Yeah. If you had any advice for somebody who was just getting started in writing, yeah. And I wanted to touch on that when you said, when she asked you the question about the things that make you feel at home when you come here.
Yeah.
You said Taco Bell, and it's really Tito's Tacos.
Yeah, yeah. No, but it's,
it's Tito's. He goes to Tito's.
No, but Taco Bell was... Oh, Jesus. Taco Bell was like the seminal restaurant, yeah, for us. That was the place that we went to as kids.
That's
in the
my
summertime.
Sister Annabelle.
Hi, Paul. You know, the Taco Bell was like home cooking.
Am I right? Oh,
that's the
But yeah, that was my question, though.
Yeah, how to
get started?
Yeah, you just have to write. I mean, the thing is, the same guy, Lou Asikoff, you know, the two things were people learn to read you and writers write. You know, it's pretty simple. You know, it's you're gonna do it or you're not. You know, yeah, it's just that's the only way you get better. You just gotta sit down and do it. You know.
Gracias. Oh,
all right, thank you all so much for coming. And Paul Beatty, thank you so much. I've been a fan since I was a grad student. Read White Boy Shuffle, and it was the most amazing thing I'd ever read, so thank you so much.
Thanks.
It was a huge honor.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.